Greetings, my friend. We are all interested in the future, for that is where you and I are going to spend the rest of our lives. And remember, my friend, future events such as these will affect you in the future. You are interested in the unknown, the mysterious, the unexplainable. That is why you are here. And now, for the first time, we are bringing to you the full story of what happened on that fateful day. We are giving you all the evidence based only on the secret testimony of the miserable souls who survived this terrifying ordeal. The incidents, the places. My friend, we cannot keep this a secret any longer. Let us punish the guilty. Let us reward the innocent. My friend, can your heart stand the shocking facts about
Radio Mysterioso?
Well, Sigrid laughs at the opening intro there. It's Radio Mysterioso, and hiatus last week because of Adam Gorightly's book tour here in L.A., which went really well. He spoke at the Soap Plant, and then on Tuesday at Book Soup, and then took off to Arizona. However, this week, we have arranged to have Micah Hanks on. And usually we do the introduction, you know, you put the name last, but screw that. Because I'm going to be so honest this time, I will tell you that Micah sent all his questions in advance. However, I thought up some too. Micah's the guy behind the Gray Alien Report, co-host of Speaking of Strange, the podcast with Josh Warren, and, God, tons of other stuff. And a person of like Mike. Can you hear me there, Micah? Oh, it's not coming in, so just a sec. There we go. Now it'll work.
Any relation to Abraham Lincoln?
All righty. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, I can hear you. Great. Now you're coming in too loud. So that's great. No, I'll do the adjustment on this end. I don't think you've been... No, you haven't been on the show before here, have you?
It's my first time, yeah. I'm real excited to be here, though. You know, it's funny. I've interviewed you before, and now we're kind of trading roles here. You're doing me, so...
Yeah, you know, it's people complain about, say, oh, everybody's interviewing each other. And it's like, but no, you talk to people who you're interested in and who you can possibly learn something from. What did you just say?
She
got a peanut gallery.
Sigrid said it's a ufology circle jerk.
Well, that's usually what it is. You know? Yeah, she's going to write one called Ufology Circle Jerk. Did I leave anything out in your introduction that you wanted to add?
Oh, you know, I tell you, I'm just fascinated by pretty much anything when it comes to ufology. And, of course, when it comes to people interviewing one another, you and I have certainly, we've been there, we've done that. I've read the UFO Mystic website for a long time. Yeah, I was analyzing your web stats earlier. Using some of the Webstat programs out there. And man, you guys, you and Nick Redfern have been getting unbelievable hits to your website.
Really? You know what? I can't find the website.
I can never do that with the Gray Alien Report. You know, I might actually get somewhere with my blogging.
Well, you know what? I used to have a way to look at the stats, so maybe you could send me something so that I can look that up. I'm real dumb on that area of the internet, figuring out... stats for sites, because I've got one for Radio Mysterioso, which has a few hundred listeners a week, but not for UFO Mystic, which I haven't posted at in days, because I've been all freaked out for some reason and scared to even look at the site. And then I look and there's like 27 comments waiting to be approved, and of course 25 of them are either online casinos or male enhancement stuff.
What's the source of the fear?
Oh my gosh, that is the plague of the modern blogger. I've recently actually had this happen with the Gray Alien Report. I got an email. Oh gosh, what was it? Was it 2-3 days ago? Jeez, it must have been about 3 days ago. And this was from the Google Web Analytics team, and they said, dear webmaster of GrayAlienReport.com, your website has been removed from our cache for the next 30 days due to indecent content placed on your website. And then they gave an example. It said, buy Viagra online or something like that. And so, you know, these third-party spam websites get in there.
Are you sure it wasn't because
how,
of...
Yeah, I don't know how they do it, but they always manage somehow to get into your website. And whether it's through comments or whether it's through actually hacking in and creating an admin account. I know that there was some sort of a something with some of the recent versions of WordPress where a lot of people's blogs had been hacked into by these third-party advertisers. But, you know, this sort of thing is just par for the course. You know, buy the ticket, take the ride. If you're going to have a good time and do it, you just got to weather all the good stuff and the bad stuff that comes with it.
Yeah, it's never perfect. Walter's here. You know Walter on my show, right?
Right, yeah. Walter, how you doing?
Well, he stepped out for a second. Just as I announced him, he ran out the door. I think something about ufological circle jerk pissed him off, and he ran out the door.
He hears me talking, and he runs out the door. I see how it goes.
Where are you? Are you in North Carolina, right?
Yeah, I'm over here in western North Carolina in the heart of the Appalachian Mountains. Love it over here. Surprisingly cool, you know, in spite of the climate change issues that are going on. I think this has been one of the coolest summers up here in the mountains that I recall, and I'm actually sitting here drinking a cool Rocky Mountain lager as we do this conversation.
Oh, we ought to have beers in here. I had that a couple of weeks ago. We've got Jarritos, which is a Mexican soda sold on the taco truck, which parks right below the window here. The whole time we're doing the show, I can smell burritos and taco smell coming up through the window.
Oh, well, I got to come out there sometime. If I'm ever at your way, I'm going to sit in on the program, okay, Greg?
Oh, definitely. You know, your friend that was going to put on that, what is it called, Paranormal in L.A. conference?
Yeah, Javier Ortega. Yeah, the Paranormal L.A., he's the guy behind GhostTheory.com. Good friend of mine.
Yeah, is that still on or was it canceled?
No, so far as I know, it's still on. I know they're going to have Linda Godfrey and Lauren Coleman out there. You know, I'd actually given you an email to get in touch with Javier. Have you heard from him yet?
Yeah, I did. We emailed each other. He actually lives probably like 5 miles from me. So,
no way. Oh, wow. That works out pretty good. You know, I'm over here on the East Coast, so you guys, I'm restricted to occasional telephone calls and emails when it comes to staying in touch with you all. But the good news is that, you know, hopefully if everything goes well, I'm sure it will, because Javier always puts a lot of work into anything that he does. Ghost Theory is coming along as one of the better websites out there when it comes to paranormal and esoterica. And if this conference goes well, and really when you got people like Linda Godfrey and Lauren Coleman, and I have to mention that's pretty fortuitous that he has two of the leading cryptozoological researchers that are going to be speaking this year at his conference. Because just I think probably within the last month, the kind of right wing political commentator Sean Hannity had decided to start doing this conspiracy month thing, and he'd featured a bunch of stuff about UFOs on his program. But he also did a thing about this this video that's called the Gable film, and the Gable film shows some sort of critter. I thought it was a bear at first, and that's what Javier thinks also. The more I look at it, the more I think, you know, I don't know, that thing, the way it moves, the way it acts, it's almost ape-like, but it looks like a bear. It's really a strange film. Either way, even if it's just a film that seems to show a bear attack from the 1970s recorded on 8mm film, it's scary nonetheless. And you can go on YouTube and do a search for the Gable film. But either way, Javier's blogged a lot about that. Lauren Coleman and Linda Godfrey, with her research into the Beast of Bray Road and American Werewolves and things, you know, they are both great speakers to touch on something like that. And since it's gotten some national attention, I'm sure that the Paranormal LA conference is going to go extremely well this year. And if it does go well, you know, Javier's tossed some ideas back and forth with me about, you know, a way we might be able to get me out there one of the next years. So if I'm not that way, and if you guys live 5 minutes from each other, then we're going to have to probably get together, and it's going to be some serious esoteric talk over a Mexican beer.
All right, yeah, over a Negra Modelo. Walter came back. Are you there, Walter? There you are.
Walter's here. I'm back.
Hey, Walter, I missed you the last time around. How you doing?
Good. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing excellent. I'm glad you're back in the room. I told Greg I was afraid you left when I started talking.
No.
Well, you know what? On the site I know you best for is Gray Alien Report, which has to do with UFO and alien stuff. And I was doing a search for Gray Alien Report, and one of the posts came up. It was from September of last year, I guess. It was about theoretical ufology, which is what I and a bunch of people I know have been doing and writing about for years, but I never really heard it put that way. And it's nice to know that it might be something that is part of the study of that kind of stuff. I hate using that word ufology. There's no such thing.
Yeah, absolutely. It's hard to quantify. There's another crazy word for you, but it's hard to really draw accurate patterns and associations between related phenomena when we don't know really what a quote-unquote UFO is to begin with. I mean, we can assume that they may be denizens of the Hollow Earth who have existed alongside mankind for centuries, if not, thousands of years or more. They could be extraterrestrial visitors. They could be interdimensional entities that come here from someplace else. We really don't know. And it's really, really tricky when we don't know anything more about, once again, quote-unquote ufology than we do to try and say, oh, these are UFOs, unidentified flying objects, These things, well, okay, the best example I can give you right now for the dissemination between those ideas is we refer to them as UFOs because that's the term they gave them when these, phenomenon in modern times were in their infancy, back around the time of the Roswell crash and Kenneth Arnold's first sighting, both of which took place in 1947. We were riding out on the coattails of World War II. We were still really afraid of Russian technology. The Red Scare stuff was brewing in the Far East. We didn't know if it was alien technology or if it was just foreign technology that might be, very dangerous to the American homeland. And so this stuff was, it was put on lockdown. This technology was kept secret. We already had this great experience with, H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds as read by Orson Welles, and we saw people's public reaction to that. And that's something that's probably, used a little too much in the modern, comparisons when it comes to UFOs and things and how the public might react. Everybody wants to say, oh, Orson Welles, we know that people would just freak out, if the government or any, governing body went ahead and released all their information about UFOs. But we have this almost archaic notion of unidentified flying objects because aerial phenomenon was the best way we could relate to these things at the time. And recently, these Russian UFO documents have been released, although I have to say I haven't actually seen an electronic version made available on the web yet of these Russian naval documents that everyone's talking about in the media. The news reports, actually there have been Russian naval officials interviewed on Fox News a couple of times, as I understand, that verify these reports, but these Russian naval documents talk about how more than 50% of all their encounters with these quote-unquote UFOs actually occur underwater in places like Lake Baikal in Russia, and of course, in hot spots, if you will, in
right.
The Atlantic Ocean, like the Bermuda Triangle, and off the coast of Puerto Rico, and places like that. Puerto Rico being a place where two good friends of mine, Chris McCollum, who's in the next room eating a hot dog, and Joshua Warren, who's, I'm not sure where Josh is.
He's
I think
somewhere
Josh
eating something else.
Buddy Nick Redfern down in Texas right now. But Joshua Warren and Chris McCollum, both Lemur investigators, the team that I'm a part of, have spent a lot of time down there in Puerto Rico, and Nick Redfern, too. And all these areas, have been deemed hotspots for UFO activity, these flying objects as we know them. But really, the Russian Navy, who've been, flying their submarines around in the international waters off the coast of these areas, and throughout the Bermuda Triangle, they say, we see these things more often underwater than we do in the sky. So, that's the USO thing that Ivan Sanderson used to talk about. It almost kind of defies this modern conception of UFOs. And I can relate to you on hating that term ufology. We really almost seem to learn more and more each day, and it tells us more and more about what we don't know.
Yeah, you want to hear? I was just thinking about that. I'm reading for the first time The Silver Bridge.
Oh, really?
I always wanted to read it, and I have a copy of it that's been sitting on my desk for months because Andy Colvin, the Mothman photographer guy, got it republished along, I think, with Alan Greenfield. Here's John Keel. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Here's John Keel talking to Gray Barker in 1966. And this is a quote. "The thing that's really beginning to bother me is that I'm developing a gnawing suspicion that the Air Force has been right all along and has been telling us part of the truth all along. After all, they've always claimed there was no evidence of extraterrestrial origin and so on. I jumped into print with this kind of conclusion. All the buffs would scream. If I jumped into print with this kind of conclusion, all the UFO buffs would scream that I'd been silenced or bought off or some such nonsense." It's a little bit, about three more sentences. "I've got to admit the Air Force's position makes more sense to me every day. Maybe the government has always realized that the truth can't be proven and that few people would believe it anyway. So they've done the only thing they could do. They've tried to play the whole thing down and dismiss it. If UFOs were around in Zechariah's time," meaning biblical time, "and in 1866, they'll probably be around in 2066 too, and just as aloof as us of us as they've always been. UFO buffs keep waiting for them to land on the White House lawn. I don't think that's ever going to happen. Instead, people like Zechariah Denton and Woody Derenberger," these are contactees, "will continue to undergo wild experiences which can't be proven, and which few people will want to believe. And guys like you and I will spend our lives running around trying to find all the pieces to the puzzle, which doesn't seem to have any definite shape or borders." 1966!
Yeah, and isn't that a timely phrase?
40 years ago!
You know, the Obama administration, they're in office, and everyone has high hopes that President Obama is going to be the one, you know, the guy who's going to release this information, disclose UFO documents. Funny thing about UFO disclosure here in the United States. I actually did a blog at the Graylian Report recently that talked about how, you know, the Canadian government, kind of always had their UFOs available. The British government, you know, they released a lot of their classified documents, but they've been more forthcoming in decades past. And a lot of other foreign nations have been. France, they were the first to really disclose all their stuff back in, it's been almost 10 years ago, I believe, or more, probably, but the United States, everyone says, we're still waiting for ultimate disclosure of U.S. Documents regarding UFOs. But guys like Nick Redfern, I always bring him up, and he is my buddy. But I have to say that, aside from being my friend, you, Greg, and Nick also especially, have done a lot when it comes to getting information via Freedom of Information and these processes that allow disclosure of, older documents, 70s, even 1980s documents and things like that had to do with UFOs. And the funny thing is a lot of these older government documents dealing with unidentified flying objects and even discussions about unidentified flying objects with governments from places like Russia and wherever else, maybe in the Soviet Union back at the time that some of these documents were first filed, these have actually been released into the public domain. And granted, you've got all the marker, the places where the names and the places and the dates have been razored out. But, for the most part, these documents have been released, and people are waiting for UFO disclosure. But, the people who aren't really on the cusp of this sort of stuff aren't aware of the fact that, hey, a lot of government documents have already been released. It doesn't seem to indicate that there's a whole lot going on that we in the general public aren't aware of already. And these phrases like what you just read, the Mothman photographer and John Keel, guys like that, it's incredibly relevant to the state of, once again, quote-unquote, ufology today.
Well,
you mentioned the theoretical UFOs, that's the whole thing. It's like, as little as we know about this phenomenon, you got guys like Michio Kaku, a brilliant theoretical physicist, and he discusses, all his theories about type A and type B civilizations, that can harness the powers of, stars and things like that, and can, literally do the kind of stuff that Captain Kirk and Spock could do on Star Trek. You can postulate about it in terms of physics of the universe, and it's okay, but when you start trying to talk about UFOs, people go haywire and say, no. Let's not talk about these things being ancient extraterrestrials, like John Keel said. Like Eric von Daniken says in his new book, History Was Wrong. He's got a new book out, And it's funny because people have been saying this for years, but people still want to hang on to that stigma that UFOs are aliens from space. We don't know what they are. We may never know what they are in our lifetimes, but the fact remains that there are so many possibilities that they have to be explored, or else we may never be able to really crawl out from under our rock and find out what's really going on.
Well, you know what? When I hear about a lot of the disclosure stuff, it's like the kind of person that will argue or ask you a question until they hear the answer that they want.
Oh, yeah.
So what I think is happening is they're asking a question, waiting for the answer that they expect and want, and I don't think they're ever going to get that. One, because if it really is true, why reveal it? And two, which is more likely, it's not the answer that they want. And if it's not the answer that they want, there's going to be a lot more cries of foul and cover up and all that stuff, like Keel said.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's funny because Tim Beckley is one of my favorite guys. Tim Beckley.
I know Tim.
He's been harping on the Hollow Earth theory of UFOs for years. And he talked a lot about this in his Commander X books and some of the conspiracy journal books and things like that. It's so funny because people look at what Tim Beckley does and John Keel, and in recent years I've heard some of these classic researchers, if you will, referred to as demonologists. And it's funny because it seems that the mainstream UFO people, if you will, when they're not getting the theories that illustrate UFOs according to their belief system, they take the people, the progenitors of those very ideas, and they relabel them. They say, well, you're no longer a ufologist. Your theories are just so far outside what we're looking for. You're a demonologist now because we can't accept ultra-dimensionals. We can't accept the hollow earth theory and all this stuff that has to do with, denizens of the hollow earth, the Shaver mystery, and all this kind of weirdness. You know, we can't accept that in the modern ufology. It's like guilty until proven innocent. If we can't prove that these things are somehow related to UFOs, we're just not going to accept them, you know. They do prescribe to a certain belief system, and John Keel was the very one that said, in the Mothman prophecy, belief is the enemy. And that's the key right there, is that you can't tie yourself down to a belief system or a dogma. You got to be open-minded. But, it's a catch-22, because the more open-minded you are, it seems that, sometimes the more confusing these weird phenomena tend to be. You hear guys like, Stan Friedman and people like that discussing the physics of UFOs. And then you've got people and he was definitely an interesting fella, but the late Jan-Erik Beckyard, who said that Bigfoot, and creatures like that were interdimensional creatures. Now, I'm not saying that Jan-Erik Beckyard, and I mean this in all love, but he definitely was a strange fella. The last thing Jan-Erik Beckyard said to me before he died was, stop being weird. I was trying to schedule him for an interview, and I said, when's the best time to call you? And he shot me an email. He said, now. And I said, okay, well, it's 2:00 in the morning. Are you sure this is an okay time? He says, stop being weird. The interview never happened. But needless to say, some of the theories that he proposed, as far out as they may sound, they have to be taken into consideration because we know so little about the phenomenon that we have nothing to compare it to begin with.
Yeah, well, exactly. The problem is we've got a mind that likes categories. And if you can't put something in a category, that becomes, people don't like fence sitting. People don't like... You know, if you've ever been on a consultant for something or for a TV show or something like that, they'll ask you a question, and then when you start equivocating, you go, no, you can't do that. You have to tell us what you think, what you believe. And I said, I don't believe one thing. I believe there are many possibilities. Well, you got to stick to something, because otherwise people will tune out. And what? You can argue with them, but they're right. Unfortunately, they're right. People have been told to... find one system and stick to it. Even if, hopefully if there's something wrong with it, you change your opinion, but that doesn't happen very often.
Right. And I hear the same thing in the political spectrum,
exactly.
You've got to be a Democrat or you've got to be a Republican. You've got to be right or you've got to be left. You can't be in the middle. Well, I'm a registered independent, and I don't feel that there are, Republicans and Democrats. I think that there are good people, and then there are well, to be more honest, really, I think that, although I'm sure that there are the corrupt politicians out there, I don't want to make a statement that you know, makes me sound naive here, but I think that I want to think, at least, that most politicians, and like I said, I know that there's some crooked swine out there, you know, who really want basically money and they're only concerned about their own. But there are people right here in North Carolina, for instance. I know that, you know, in my district, you know, our North Carolina Congressman Keith Schuler has been doing an excellent job trying to hear what the people have to say. Keith Schuler, you know, I've met him a few times because I work in radio here in Western North Carolina. And, you know, my first impression of him, since he was a former football player, was, you know, is this guy really going to be able to get in there and, you know, fight with the heavyweights in politics? He really does a good job trying to help people. And although he's, you know, a Democrat, if you're a conservative, you know, I've known many people in this area who are, you know, dyed-in-the-wool Republicans who said, you know, I sent the guy an email, I got a reply. Recently, I sent him an email myself. I got a reply from this fella too, and he wasn't dismissive because I label myself, you know, an independent, because, you know, I believe that he is a human being, and I appreciated that. He replied, and he sent me a very long email, you know, discussing, you know, some of the current states of, you know, of affair in the state legislature and, you know, some of the economic situations that we're facing right now. But the point I'm trying to make here is that, you know, using politics as an analogy, a lot of these modern pundits, they want to say, you know, right or left, pick your side. If you can't pick one or the other, you're just indecisive and you don't really know what's going on. But the people who seem to really get it know that a two-party system isn't working and that we really need to broaden our spectrum and be open-minded and get people in there who are really listening to the people, you know, the small folk like myself, you know, these hillbillies up here in the mountains. And looking at it in terms of, you know, the way that the paranormal or anything esoteric relates to that, why exist in a black and white world when gray is an option? And gray is an option, it's the truth. We don't have to say this or that. There is no in between. You have to take into consider those, take into consideration those in betweens. Because when you don't, you limit yourself. You know, you completely limit yourself.
Right.
And I'm sure that there are a lot of people who read the Graylian report, you know, and read some of the articles. And I've heard people say things like, "Oh, this guy's whimsical. This man is really strange." I don't really even get that far out there. This is a thing that really kind of ticks a lot of people off about my writing, is that they say, "Oh, Micah A. Hanks, he's a skeptic, and we don't like those guys. We don't like them." But, you know, scientifically, there's no better way to go about investigative journalism. You know, you have to ask the tough questions. You have to be discriminating when it comes to recollections of witnesses and witness testimony and things like that. And I get criticized a lot because people say, "Well, you just don't open your mind enough." No, the thing is I open my mind probably, I try to, more than the average reader. I do attempt to. And Greg, I see you do it a lot. I see Nick Redfern do it a lot. Joshua Warren does it a lot. You know,
right.
There are more and more people who are doing this who don't just go along with the status quo. "Oh, UFOs are from space." They ask the tough questions. And by asking those tough questions, you know, you're not being a dismissive debunker. You're being skeptical, and you're being skeptical in the sense that you're asking the questions that are most relevant and most conducive to getting results. And that's the only way that we're going to make any headway, you know. So why be black or white? There is, I argue, room for gray.
Oh, there's a lot of room. You know what? We should get to the subjects we advertised that you sent to me. And I was trying to exhibit some of this honesty we're talking about by saying, Micah sent me all the questions. I had a few of my own. And, in fact, I think we've gone through a few of my own. The first thing on your list was the bloop noise that came out in the news last year. Or was it earlier this year? Maybe you should background
that,
people a little bit. Tell them what it is.
I'd written about it probably late last year or earlier this year. It's been out actually in the news for several years. This is actually the bloop noise is an interesting bit of, gosh, I don't know what you'd call it. Some people would label it cryptozoological. Some people would label it some sort of a strange earth noise or earth phenomenon. I know that Brad Steiger, who just sent me a new copy of his vampire book, which is fantastic, he was, before he was working on that, he'd been working on a monster book, and it got kind of slated. It was slated for publication, and it got kind of pushed back in favor of getting this vampire book done, if I remember correctly. But he had sent an email out to a lot of his, correspondences, his you know, followers and friends and, fellow writers. And he said, I'm writing this book about monsters, and I'd love it if people could compile their top 10 list of their favorite monsters. And when I sent Brad my top 10 list, he says, Micah, this is one of the most unique lists I've gotten. The first monster on this list was Bloop.
Uh-huh.
And for those, and although we don't know what Bloop looks like, we don't know anything more than the fact that there was a noise recorded in the 1990s sometime that was indicative of what may be a large mammal somewhere out there in the Pacific Ocean, larger than a blue whale. For those listeners of Radio Mysterioso who do not know what Bloop is, the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Association, I believe I've got the acronym correct for NOAA, they had been basically using Cold War era deep sea moored hydrophones, okay, that were they were placed at the depths of the ocean in an area called the Deep Sound Channel, okay, out in the Pacific Ocean. And these things were initially put out there to kind of monitor like seismic activity, earthquake rumbles and things like that, volcanic activity, plate shifts and things along those lines off the Pacific coast. But sometime in the mid-1990s, there were several noises that were recorded by these deep-sea hydrophones. And a hydrophone basically is just a microphone that is, suited for underwater use. These hydrophones recorded a strange noise and sped up six times so that it's audible to the human ear. This thing just sounds like a little bloop. And if you go to the Wikipedia entry, go to Wikipedia and just type in bloop, B-L-O-O-P, bloop. And on the Wikipedia entry for bloop, there's actually a link with the audio from the NOAA website, and you can hear bloop and what it sounds like. Now, when you hear the audio sped up 16 times, it just sounds like, once again, a bubble rising to the surface of a swimming pool or something. It's not very impressive. But the acoustic hallmark that this thing bore, according to, oceanographers and, acoustic analysis or acoustic seemed to indicate a very large mammal. And they said that whatever this thing was, originated from some place, furthest from land and down beneath the ocean, out there in the Pacific Ocean, and that this thing bore the acoustic hallmark of some large mammal. And they said that if indeed this noise was created by some large mammal or other creature in the Pacific Ocean, this thing would be so large to have been recorded at that distance with these hydrophones that this thing would probably be large enough to swallow a blue whale. Now, a blue whale is the largest known mammal existing on Earth today that I know of. If this thing, bloop, exists out there, wherever it is, whatever it is, they're saying it's large enough, to be, significantly bigger than a blue whale. I don't know what that is. I don't know yet what depths a creature like that could lurk, that it would be unknown to science at present. But it's interesting, nonetheless. And in addition to bloop, there were other noises recorded by these hydrophones, and NOAA analysts gave them names along the lines of slowdown, Gregorian chant, speedboat, things like that, based on what they sounded like, what they sounded most like when given a casual review. But bloop was the most interesting of all of them, because most of these, they said, could be explained away to the kinds of things that they were looking for, volcanic activity, seismic activity beneath the earth and that sort of stuff. Sometimes even sonar rigs and large seagoing vessels recorded above the surface.
Yeah.
But whatever bloop was, they said that it seemed to indicate a large mammal, a very very large mammal, and it's frightening to think that something that large could exist. Now, of the questions that you had mentioned, I also had talked a lot about my interest in Lovecraft, and at this point I have to kind of jump into a little bit of that, because it's funny. in the short story that H.P. Lovecraft wrote that was called The Call of Cthulhu, probably one of his most famous stories.
Yeah.
There is a derelict, a little ship at sea and everything, that encounters this strange island at the climax of the story. It has this this strange kind of, geometry, this island that defies physics as we know it. I think it's non-Euclidean or something is what they call that. And this island is the sunken city of, I believe it's pronounced Relay, and that's where Cthulhu had basically been resting. And most people, I guess, who read Lovecraft kind of assume that what they're talking about is Cthulhu is some sort of an alien being that was kind of banished to Earth and was, saved in some sort of a state of suspended animation. And the cultists in the story, the Cthulhu worshippers, would kind of chant, in the sunken Relay, dead Cthulhu waits dreaming. So I always took that to mean that he was kind of waiting in suspended animation beneath the Pacific Ocean. Cthulhu was a very large squid-like monster. And it's funny because in the story, H.P. Lovecraft gives the coordinates for where Cthulhu rested beneath the ocean. And it's almost frightening because the coordinates he gave were almost exactly where they said in the 1990s that the bloop noise originated from. So there's this strange Lovecraftian parallel between giant monsters and this area out there in the southern Pacific that is furthest from land in these deep trenches beneath the Pacific Ocean where some giant something may exist. Is it Cthulhu? Is it something else? Is it a deep sea alien base? I don't know. But it's fascinating, and it certainly ranks as my number one most frightening monster.
Yeah, while you were talking there, I played the bloop noise off Wikipedia here.
Oh, there you go. That's it. Yeah, so now the listeners can hear the frightening verbiage of Cthulhu.
Yeah, it says played at 16 times normal speed.
There you go, yeah.
Yeah. I feel like Art Bell. Let's hear that again.
Greg, we talked on the telephone today before the interview, and we were talking about being both of us being fans of Art Bell. And of course, I love George Norrie too. I mean, George is a great host; and he does a great job. I grew up listening to Art Bell, and I'm as much a fan of Art Bell as I am George Norrie. And I think that he's one of those classic radio hosts, and Norrie. George Norrie's talked about a presidential bid in 2012, and if the world doesn't, he's definitely got my vote. Both the Coast to Coast hosts there. Well, I say both, but in all fairness, Ian punted also. I really enjoy listening to Ian on the weekends. His sense of humor is great, but Art Bell was just that quintessential cynic, and he was great. And he loves playing the audio bites, didn't he?
Yeah, he liked that. I remember he played an audio of a cat attacking or something. And he played it over and over during the show just to tease everybody's cat that happened to be listening.
Yeah.
Hold on, get away from your cat.
Yeah, oh, God. My favorite Art Bell audio was
he's a radio person.
From Hell. Do you remember that one?
The what?
It was The Sounds from Hell. And
that sounded like a bunch of people.
There, so you might be able to hear this little fellow barking. He sees a cat outside or something. Sam's in the other room there, my little, he's a mutt, but he's a cute dog, and he's very angry at something outside the window right now. But either way, Art Bell, he did maybe a couple of programs where he played this audio that was allegedly Sounds from Hell.
And yeah, well, they had...
funny because the story behind it was that they lowered this microphone down into a hole that was drilled somewhere in, like, Siberia.
Yeah.
Or someplace in the east. They'd been trying to dig a, the drill for oil. Eventually, they'd gotten into this, such a depth that they go any deeper, and they lowered the microphone to the hole. And they recorded these sounds that sounded like hundreds and thousands of voices, screaming and torture and things. I thought it sounded like a microphone in a basketball gymnasium high school someplace. so I kind of coined this term at the time. Hell is a high school basketball game. But
it is.
That'll always be one of my favorite Coast to Coast audio bites. Yeah, Sounds from Hell.
Let's see. Is this the recording of Hell?
Oh, he's found it already. Greg, you're resourceful. See, that's what they fear about the middle class. We're resourceful.
Weeping, screaming, wailing, and gnashing of teeth. sa isa pong kilala.
No, it's some that was some Filipino show. It's a Filipino religious show. Wait. Yeah, they have some music. There it is. There we go. Sounds of hell. Or a high school basketball game. Yeah, I think that's the one that Art Bell played.
That's it. The famous Sounds of Hell. It's almost comforting to hear that again. It's an old favorite of mine.
Yeah, another of my favorites was the guy who flew into Area 51 and talked to him on the phone.
Oh, yeah. I remember that. You know, if you go to the Wikipedia entry on, it's either the Wikipedia entry on Art Bell or the one on Coast to Coast AM. I think it's the entry for Art. You know, it talks about some of the most famous callers. You know, there was a famous religious kind of religioso guy named JC, which, you know, I'll go ahead and point it out. You know, for those who aren't Coast to Coast listeners, you know the obvious connotation there. But, you know, JC being the initials for Jesus Christ. And, a lot of people thought that, you know, Art from time to time would stage these calls just to bring an entertainment aspect to the program. And, you know,
right.
I wouldn't put that past Art. Art is an entertainer, and it's what I call, and actually I have to give props to my friend Matt Matan. He is a political talk radio host here in North Carolina. But Matt Matan has always called his brand of political commentary infotainment. Infotainment because you get information, but it's entertaining, you know, and that's what Art was. Art was an infotainer, you know, and he's probably one of the very best, too. He's excellent. And, you know, I know, Greg, you saw that recent interview with Art in Wired Magazine where they kind of talked to him very briefly, and then they went to their website, and I saw that you put that up on UFO Mystic. But it was good to see, after all these years, you know, now that he's basically just a fill-in for the incomparable George Norrie. You know, it's good to see Art still getting a little press. You know, he was basically the creator of the program, you know, the kind progenitor of what we know now as Coast to Coast AM.
Yeah, Greg had to step out for a moment. This is Walter. But you're absolutely right. Art did stuff that they just don't do anymore, and I kind of wish they would. I personally miss the Mel's Hole stuff. I never heard what the final outcome of that was, but I always found that to be interesting.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, there's so much interesting subject matter that gets tossed around. And it's funny, there's a subculture that's built around that late-night talk radio element. You know, I've actually heard people say that, a program like Coast to Coast AM wouldn't work during the daytime. I think it was Art Bell that actually said that in that Wired magazine interview that I was referencing, which I know that Greg's read as well. That there's actually this fringe element that, you know, and I don't know if it's just the weird people stay up late at night. You know, here in my time right now, here in Western North Carolina, it's almost midnight. And I'm so used to booking shows, because I do actually, I'm the executive producer, but also I occasionally I'm a guest host for Joshua P. Warren on his radio program, Speaking of Strange. And, I'm used to booking guests for Joshua's program. And Greg told me, you know, we're going to do this interview. It's going to be from 8 to 11 p.m. Our time. And I said, oh, great. Well, that's like 5 to 7 p.m. my time. And I wrote him that in the email. And he said, no, dude, that's from, 11 o'clock until 1 a.m. Is that still cool? And so I totally got my time zones backward because I'm so used to booking West Coast guests and counting backwards, you know. So
right.
I did it again. But either way, you know.
All the weirdos are out here.
Where I am. It's getting late, and I'm certainly one of those late night guys. I do all my writing usually in the late night hours, and I think that Art Bell's right. You know, there's this mentality, these people that stay up all night. I don't think they're crazy. I think that they're just people who are maybe willing to be on the cusp of what's yet to come. You know, think of it like this: if you're a blogger or if you're a journalist and you want to report world news, whether it has to do with UFOs or paranormal subjects or politics or global affairs, economy, whatever. If you're up all night, in a different time zone, somewhere across the globe where it's morning when it's the middle of the night where you are, you know, you're getting the morning news elsewhere in the middle of the night. And it's those people, you know, the Art Bells, the George Norris, the Ian Punnett, you know, that are willing to stay up all night and just be on the cusp of what's happening, you know. It's not the kind of thing that you can get in the drive time, you know, 9 to 5 weekday that most Americans have, you know, that nighttime element. It's fascinating. It's not for everyone, but there's a little magic to it, you know, and Coast to Coast and programs like that somehow tap into that.
Well, there's that idea from, was it Greg Little's book or, no, it was somebody, maybe it was Greg Little. He was talking about the, what happens to the atmosphere and to people and to, you know, radiations from space and all that when you're on the night side of the planet. You don't have all that noise from the sun screwing things up. So there may be something, there may be some, you know, occult rituals are done at night for the most part. Well, always, I think. I find I can think better in the middle of the night, you know, that kind of thing. But there's a point to be made that there's some sort of, you know, worldwide open secret society that operates from, you know, from sundown to sunup, and maybe mostly after midnight.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Greg, you're absolutely right. It's and it's funny you mention that because, you know, with Lemur, and Lemur,
why don't you tell people what that is?
I'm unfamiliar with that acronym. That's Joshua P. Warren's, you know, this is the funny thing. It's always been referred to as a paranormal investigation team, but what really Lemur is a collective group of truth seekers. And I know that that's kind of, you know, oh, they're truth seekers. They're you know, only, you know, scholarly fellows. You know, well, Lemur, which stands for League of Energy Materialization and Unexplained Phenomenon Research. Lemur, over the years, the personnel's changed. I've been an investigator with Lemur since about 2004. Joshua formed the group probably back in the early 90s. But since its conception, the Lemur research team has done a lot of field work. And now we focus a lot of our energy in the laboratory, trying to take, you know, information that we've gathered in the field from ghosts, you know, and haunting sites, you know, you go to haunted houses and places like that, you know, so places where ghosts are alleged to be seen. And then you've got, you know, places where cryptozoological, you know, monstrosities appear. Bigfoot, we've investigated everything from lake monsters to Bigfoots throughout the Southeast and other parts of the world. You know, Joshua, I know, is branching out, and he's doing a lot of stuff out west. He's headed down to Texas to see Nick Redfern here, I think, next week. But with Lemur's research over the last, you know, more than a decade, you know, of collective research that Lemur's done over the, you know, over the years, one thing that Josh has always said is that, you know, you have this classic, almost archetypical nighttime element. And, you know, you hear these terms like the witching hour or dark 30, you know, things like that, or, you know, midnight oil, or burning the midnight oil, I think is the actual term. And it seems to be that paranormal phenomenon in general is often linked to nighttime occurrences. And it's funny because, like you're talking about, Greg, Earth's geomagnetic field is less inhibited by solar activity, you know, flares and whatnot, and solar radiation in general, when you are on the side of the Earth furthest from the sun, which is, of course, you know, where it appears as night relative to where you are.
Right.
So it's funny, but it makes sense in terms of the way that there are always electromagnetic anomalies that seem to be correlated with, you know, ghostly manifestations, sometimes UFO activity. I've heard that, you know, some of the popular quote-unquote ghost meters, which is the Trifield Natural Electromagnetic Field Meter, on settings, you know, the I think it's the, you know, one of the magnetic or one of the geomagnetic settings, they say that, you know, when UFO sightings take place, when geological experts are using these things to monitor geomagnetic activity and things like that in the wild, and in the, you know, in the field, rather. They say that, you know, if there's ufological type activity or anything like that, these things have been known to go wild. Similarly, you know, you take one into a haunted house and you can measure not only, you know, energy field produced by human bodies, but you can also measure transient electromagnetic fields that seem to respond to the meter the same way that a electric field by a human body might, but there's no human body present. these effects are magnified often in the evening. And so once again, you know, these electromagnetic phenomena do seem to have something to do with paranormal phenomena, and they seem most active at night when the Earth is less, the geomagnetic, field that surrounds our planet is less inhibited by the solar radiation. And, you know, it almost seems to kind of make a scientific window to which paranormal phenomena can kind of escape. So, you know, when you hear these sort of like the witching hour and things like that, I think there's a reason why archetypically and historically paranormal phenomena always seems to be linked to nighttime.
Well, it might be, I was thinking about it while you were talking there, that the electromagnetic effect might be the, what's the word, might be the only thing that we can detect with instruments besides our body of something that's coming from wherever these things are coming from. It's its projection into our awareness manifests sometimes as electromagnetic anomalies. Not the other way around, where you try to flood somebody with electromagnetic radiation and induce some sort of experience, which, of course, Michael Persinger did in the 70s.
Yeah, and his research was fascinating. I've actually been working on a book, which we talked about a little bit today, but excuse me. I've been fascinated with that kind of research where electric fields basically were brought in close proximity to the frontal lobe and the right cortex, various parts of the of the human brain, and these electric fields when in close proximity to the human brain tended to elicit these strange responses. Now, Persinger's research didn't, to my knowledge, induce psychedelic experiences. Although, when we're talking about ghostly phenomena, people who, participated in Persinger's studies said, we felt as though we were in, the presence of some sort of intelligence or some sort of a being. There was a presence in the room with us. They were put in an empty room with soundproof walls, and people heard voices, people heard noises, people said they felt presences. It's fascinating stuff. And it reminds me of a story that was reported in England a few years ago called Quantock Horror. The Quantock Horror was the report of a fellow who had gone out walking in the hills, the Quantock Hills near his home there in England. And he's been walking along, and suddenly he sees this thing that looks like Mothman, flying overhead. It's this big winged creature, and he takes photographs of it, and he's just terrified. A well-known ufologist was brought in to examine the photographs, and this fellow said, there's something in the photos, but it looks like a man in a hang glider. The witness also described having all different kinds of strange things happening around his house, which included, seeing little men. He described little men that might sound similar to your classic gray aliens, which is, of course, when you talk about gray aliens, that's kind of where the idea for my website, Graylian, I threw the two words, Graylian report, together. But these typical little gray aliens, and little humanoids like that would appear in his house, especially at night. And he said that they'd blast him with rays, powerful rays that would hurt him and freeze him and kind of disable him in different ways. Well, it came to the attention of the ufologist that he lived under a very intense row of electrical pylons. These incredibly large electric cables ran directly over his house. And in addition to that, early in his youth, I think he was probably in his late teens or early 20s, this witness had also experienced a very intense electrical accident where he was badly shocked. And he seemed to suffer from some sort of electrical hypersensitivity as a result of this. And it seems to be that other people who suffer from this, I think the disorder is called EHMA, electrical hypersensitivity and multiple allergy. I think there's the actual long name for this. But these people all describe sensitivity to electric field. They can't stand near microwave oven. They can't stand near fluorescent light bulbs, televisions, all these things just bother them, give them headaches, make them feel icky, radios, things like that. And many of these people, when they're in you know, proximity to intense electric fields, describe having various either psychedelic kinds of experiences or vivid hallucinations. It could almost be likened to the kinds of things that schizophrenic patients describe.
Right.
Beings appearing, hearing voices. So, you know, Persinger wanted to try and see if it would be possible to induce that kind of experience in a person who didn't seem to suffer from electrical hypersensitivity. Indeed, he was able to. And once again, you know, to draw that Lovecraftian parallel, it's funny because in that story From Beyond, there's a character, Tillinghast. It was Crawford Tillinghast was the doctor's name in the story. And he creates this device that he said could resonate electrically with the pineal gland, or the pineal gland. I hear it pronounced both ways. I think it's really the pineal gland. The ancient Greeks who first wrote about the discovery of the pineal gland said it resembled a pine cone, as I understand. So pineal gland, supposedly,
right.
Although I wouldn't think that their actual name for it would be the same as what we call it here in America, you know, or in English at least, a pine cone. But either way, pineal, that's how I tend to remember that. The pineal gland resonated with this device that Crawford Tillinghast had created. And as a result, you were able to see into another dimension and see these strange creatures. And at the climax of the story, one is appearing right behind the narrator, and he pulls out a revolver and shoots the machine and destroys it just in time to save his own life. The doctor, Crawford Tillinghast, dies. He has something along the line of a hemorrhage in his brain or something. But it's interesting because Nikola Tesla said that when you were in close proximity to his Tesla coils, the high-output Tesla coils, he said that he thought that you might be able to see something akin to shifts in dimensional activity in the resonant rise of a Tesla coil. That wasn't a direct quote, but that was kind of in essence, you know, an accumulation of several things that Tesla said throughout his lifetime with regard to his experiments with Tesla coils. And I got to thinking about that, about Tesla talking about seeing strange dimensional weirdness in close proximity to high-output electrical devices, and then Lovecraft's idea of electrical stimulus to the pineal gland causing, you know, visions of things from other worlds. And then you hear about researchers like Dr. Rick Strassman, who in the 1980s and 90s was conducting his dimethyltryptamine, or DMT, research. And Greg, you've interviewed Rick Strassman. He's a fascinating guy. I interviewed him for my book, which is not to print yet, so I won't give the title just yet. But, you know, hopefully in a future installment I can tell you more about that. But
okay.
The DMT research that he did involved people who had encounters with various different kinds of humanoid, you know, anthropomorphic alien beings while undergoing the DMT experience. And interestingly, Strassman's whole hypothesis was that DMT might be released into the human body by the pineal gland. So what if the kinds of things that Tesla was describing with regard to being in close proximity to these electrical fields was the same sort of thing that Lovecraft unknowingly predicted and what he wrote about? Electrical fields might somehow stimulate the pineal gland and introduce into the human body, or rather, to borrow Rick Strassman's term, trigger an endogenous release of DMT into the body and cause a psychedelic experience where people actually are able to see strange beings and things like that. Who knows? And that could be exactly what Persinger was tapping into, but there's so little known about the pineal gland, DMT, and the way these things affect the human body that, once again, we're in one of these realms where we really don't know enough about it to be able to determine how it works and why people who experience these things see what they see.
Well, there's an argument to be made, which I'm sure people have brought up with you and with these people, that how do you know this stuff is just not in, you know, native to the human brain, and it's just our quote-unquote imagination? What's the argument for some kind? And I know what I know what my argument is. But what's the argument for some sort of external reality, if you want to call it, to these things experienced under psychedelics or strong electromagnetic fields, etc.?
Well, you know, I guess it's kind of hard to say. When people talk about the imagination being a factor, I think it's hard to disclose that. And a good way to illustrate that is, you know, I was reading a report. As a matter of fact, actually, when I was sending you ideas for tonight's discussion, I mentioned Popobawa,
right,
which is this Mothman. Yes, this Mothman-like creature that's seen in Zanzibar and Tasmania, and places like that. And it's some sort of a winged demon, sometimes with one eye in the center of its forehead. And it's actually, strangely, described as having a very large male member. And this creature, they call it the skeptic, this is the strangest name ever, the skeptic raping demon, because this thing allegedly is known in these strange circumstances where it encounters people in the evenings to crawl in their window, rape them, sexually assault them, and warn them that if you don't talk about the experience of being sexually assaulted by the Popobawa, I'll come back and I'll do it again. Skeptic Inquirer did an article about it, and that I think they're the ones that coined this term, the skeptic raping demon of Zanzibar. And they said, we can tell you exactly what Popobawa is. Popobawa and Popo and Bawa, they're actually two different words that mean, wing and bat, or bat and wing, something along those lines, you know, that basically means a bat-winged demon. But they said Popobawa is sleep paralysis, the exact same thing. This is a neurological disorder. It's a form of clinical psychosis that is intermittent, and hundreds of, if not thousands of Americans suffer from, probably more than that, frankly, but the numbers they give are pretty good. But they say that Americans suffer in large quantities from this sleep paralysis. Now, I interviewed a guy named Dr. David Hufford, PhD, and he talked about how, from culture to culture around the world, there are many definitions, but they all describe the same thing. Sleep paralysis is experienced by many people. I've experienced it myself. Dr. Hufford, when I interviewed him, said I, had several experiences while I was in college 30 years ago, and, that's what got my research going. So I was really interested to hear Dr. Hufford talk about this, and he said it's just a shame that people call this a clinical psychosis, and that everyone who experiences sleep paralysis is suffering from some mild psychotic episode. He says that's just a shame, and it's terrible, because to explain away is fascinating, but it's something that's potentially revealing about human nature is sleep paralysis. As psychosis, it just labels it and sets it aside. We'll put you on some medication, and hopefully you'll forget this. You'll be okay. When in reality, there may be things we could learn from this. Now, you could look at that as some sort of a bizarre manifestation of the human psyche, some sort of a consciousness thing that, besets us in that realm between sleep and awake. You could look at it as the imagination playing tricks on us, or we could look at it as something more. I think that the DMT is kind of, a different house but on the same street. It all has to do with neural and brain function and the way that the mind and the brain information and how that relates to the body and how it receives input and stimuli from different sources. We don't, once again, this is, I think, what makes the quote-unquote paranormal people sound crazy all the time, is because we don't know any better, and in many cases, I don't think we know any less than people who have long strings of letters like PhDs and MDs behind names, but we certainly don't know any more about what you can do to quantify and draw patterns and associations between these kinds of phenomena. We know that we have a name for sleep paralysis. We know that dimethyltryptamine has a psychedelic effect on the human mind. We don't know exactly why that occurs or what the psychedelic visions mean, or if they're anything more than psychosis, but what is psychosis? And if DMT, as Rick Strassman says, if created in the human mind, and it's actually, something that's common to humans, and it's found in our bloodstream, in very small quantities, but nonetheless it's present, what purpose does that serve in the function of the human mind? How does that help or hinder, what process does that serve, and how does that help us as a species? How has that helped us evolve? It's fascinating stuff, but really, especially taking a skeptical approach, it's hard to differentiate that between something that's just imaginary,
And I think that's why, for a lot of people, aliens, ghosts, Bigfoot, all these things kind of inhabit the realm of the imaginary. Although, really, there may be something more. We don't know if DMT is some sort of, you know, Strassman calls it the spirit molecule. What if, indeed, it is a molecule that allows humans limited perception of alternate dimensions? I don't know. That's fascinating to me. But, you know, how would you differentiate that from being imaginary, you know?
Yeah, well, we run into the problem of definition, which is what, when I get that question, how do you know it's just people just imagining things? But, yeah, and you just basically explained it. You run into the problem of definition. You know, what is imagination? What, you know, how do we perceive things in our, you know, in our experience? How do we categorize them, which is very important? And if we can't, one, reproduce it on demand, or two, have it measurable by instruments, does that mean that it doesn't exist? And like, and you and I would probably argue, no, it doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It just means that we have to look at it possibly in a different way, or with a different mindset, or forget the categories, or whatever you want to call it.
Absolutely, and that's what science is to me. Science really is a human perspective of phenomenon. Okay, witnessed phenomena. That's all it is a human perspective. I love that that analogy we get of a one-dimensional creature that travels back and forth against a along a single line.
Right.
And suddenly a U shape, like the letter U, a horseshoe-shaped two-dimensional entity appears and checks that one-dimensional line. Well, a little creature that's traveling back and forth, his entire existence is really interesting. He goes back and forth, left and right, across a single one-dimensional plane all day. When this two-dimensional horseshoe-shaped creature intersects the one-dimensional plane, okay, the two prongs of the horseshoes, okay, intersect the single line at two different areas, okay? So according to a creature, hypothetically, that might exist in a one-dimensional realm, a two-dimensional creature, based on its shape, might appear to exist in two separate places, or it might appear to be two separate entities, but indeed it's actually, you know, two parts of the same thing. So that would, you know, appear to be very confusing to a one-dimensional little critter that travels back and forth across a single plane. He sees one creature that appears simultaneously in two places.
Right.
And that really throws him for a loop. Now, we live in the three-dimensional realm, you know, and when we think about fourth and fifth-dimensional realities in terms of, you know, string theory and quantum physics, if, for instance, you know, aliens from a fourth dimension, okay, are able to extend into the third dimension where we are, and we're able to witness them, there are going to be aspects of that phenomenon that, much like the two-dimensional creature in a one-dimensional realm, they're going to appear not to make sense. You know, I'm not going to say that, you know, it's going to look like an alien spaceship appears both in front of you over there on the West Coast and then in front of me over here in the Appalachian Mountains at the same time, although that very well may be the case. I think that, you know, some of these things like this incredible speed UFO craft are, you know, described as being able to travel, and some of the strange maneuvers that they're able to manage, you know, and just lightning fast maneuverability. These aspects of the propulsion of flying saucers seem to defy physics as we know it. But that doesn't mean it's impossible and that it can be ruled out. The skeptics, okay, take a humanistic perspective of science and say that's impossible. But when you think about things in terms of string theory and ultra-dimensionals and, you know, multiple dimensions, I think Michio Kaku uses that term, multiverse. When you look at it in terms of a multiverse, we can't possibly understand how, you know, multidimensional beings would be perceived logically to three-dimensional beings like you or I. It doesn't make any sense. And so, you know, once again, just because it doesn't meet our criteria for what is observable and, you know, pattern-based phenomenon doesn't mean that there isn't some sort of a scientific basis for it, which brings us back to this notion that I talk about, theoretical ufology. We can theorize all day about physics and the nature of the universe and the mysteries of how the universe works, you know? But when we try and do the same thing with UFOs, we get branded as crazy. All we're trying to do is we're trying to apply the dark areas, okay, the or the gray areas, if we want to use our analogy from earlier, mm-hmm. that fall between known phenomena in science from our limited human perspective, and try to apply that to understanding and broadening our perspective of the nature of the universe as we know it. We really, you know, our perspective as humans is so limited, and we limit ourselves every day by dismissing this sort of thing. But really, you know, guys like Kaku, you know, are on the cusp of understanding what extraterrestrial intelligence and UFOs and things like this are and how they behave, because they're the only ones that seem to be willing to take into consideration, wow, things that may not make sense to us, things that may seem imaginary, may indeed be observable phenomena, but we don't understand the science that we would apply to that to make sense of it.
Right. You know, it's a nice analogy you have, which I've heard before, and I wish I'd bring it up more when people ask me that question, or that kind of a question. But the reality of it may be at a different angle or orthogonal or whatever you want to call it to ours. And there's a idea that I try to push that UFOs and aliens and ghosts, and we'll talk about this too a little bit later, about the intersection, Bigfoot, whatever, cryptids, that
yeah.
their reality is in every when and in everywhere, as from our perspective. And every once in a while, from our perspective, these things will pop out and be visible in the way that we can accept them, if you want to use that term in quotes. And that's kind of what I work with until I find something else, you know, a better model. And that comes from lots of different sources, you know, lots of different writers and lots of different people I've talked to. But it seems to be something that holds up across all this paranormal phenomena. I mean, only there for a little while. They're never there for hours or, well, sometimes they are, days, anything like that. They're very short-lived. They're very random. And it seems like only certain people can see them in some situations. To me, that sounds like that things that are not locked into the time and space thing that we're all used to from high school physics and from the media and Nova and Discovery and all that. Still there?
Yeah, absolutely.
I know. I'm just basically repeating what you said, but that's okay.
That's good. That, you know what? We're on the same page, though. That's good. You know, you said it in a lot less time. You took a lot less time to say it than I do. I get diarrhea of the mouth sometimes, and I just keep going and going and going. But, you know, yeah, you
Me
did
too.
A good job outlining it.
Oh, okay. Well, thanks. You had a list of tons of stuff. What we were just talking about goes to one of my questions.
Okay.
What about what I just mentioned and you were just talking about? What are the parallels? Since you're interested in all these things, I am too. You probably dug into some of these things a lot more than I have, vis-a-vis hauntings and cryptids and all that. But there are definite connections that nobody ever really makes, really, in a public forum between paranormal stuff, between all these things like cryptids and ghosts and UFOs and aliens and all that. There are very definite parallels between them. And I wanted to know what you uh-huh. thought those parallels, and I know you probably agree with me, what those parallels might be, what might be behind that seeming affinity of all these things that are just out of, or maybe further out of our perceptual reach, at least conceptual reach, actually.
Well, that's a good question. You know, it's funny because I've heard, you know, various researchers say, don't draw parallels between things. Don't try and compare, you know, UFOs and Bigfoot, because when you take two unknowns and you try and draw comparisons between them, all you're going to do, I mean, well actually, a better analogy would be to say, you know, two negatives don't always make a positive. You're not always going to take two unknowns, put them together and try and correlate them and then solve the mystery. If anything, what that usually will do is it will, you know, dilute what evidence is available.
Well,
and
that's
I've heard
stupid.
A lot of investigators say, you know, don't try and compare seemingly unrelated paranormal phenomena, because you're just going to dilute the body of evidence that we're trying to put together. Now, there is an argument to be made for that, But once again, unfortunately, and, you know, I don't know that there's a way around this, but I feel like that, again, is a limited kind of, you know, human perspective of things. But I'm not Dr. Manhattan, you know. I'm not an alien. I don't have, you know, esoteric knowledge of things outside of the human realm. I'm very human. I'm flesh and blood, just like you, you know, or anyone else, you know. And, you know, we can't help but look at things as though we were humans, because we are humans. Surprise. So I don't know that there's any real way to get around this notion that we're going to have certain limitations based on our predisposition, you know, our planetary and dimensional predispositions, you know, when it comes to trying to understand a phenomenon that, you know, is so strange that we call it paranormal. It's beyond what we deem normal. But really, science looks at paranormal things almost exclusively. All things that are studied scientifically begin as paranormal phenomena. Before Isaac Newton, and granted, you know, Isaac Newton may have, you know, laid the groundwork for our fundamental understandings of Newtonian physics and also gravity when, you know, when he witnessed the apple fall, knocked him on the noggin, and he realized, huh, well, that's interesting. There must be some force that's pulling things down. But we don't, to this day, really know what gravity is. And compared to some of the forces that that act on cosmic bodies in the universe, gravity is relatively weak. So it's interesting because when we take these things into consideration, all things at one point are paranormal. They extend beyond what we understand to be quote-unquote normal. And that's what science actually seems to be more about, is trying to take phenomenon we don't understand and build a fundamental understanding of it. So, you know, when it comes to trying to relate unexplained phenomenon, it's difficult them because when they're unexplainable, that doesn't mean they don't exist, but if you want to look at it very scientifically, all that really seems to mean is that it's something that we may be able to apply science to at some point, but we either don't have the know-how to do that yet, or we haven't collected enough data to be able to do that easily. But when you collect that data, obviously they're going to have to be parallel, and at least in a preliminary way, or maybe superficially, there are statistics available already that correlate UFO hotspots, okay, and sightings of UFOs with areas known to be hotspots for Bigfoot encounters and other strange paranormal phenomena. You know, you have areas like the Bermuda Triangle where, you know, ships disappear, where there are strange, you know, electrical interferences that occur. UFOs are seen. You could look at it very superficially, and you could just say, well, maybe there's a deep-sea UFO base. And, you know, maybe their technology is, you know, something that is so powerful, and there are energy alternatives that are so greater than our present technology would allow, that these things interfere with our electrical devices. And basically, UFOs operating underneath the ocean are what cause all the bizarre things that happen in the Bermuda Triangle. You know, that's a great theory. A lot of people propose that. I think even Charles Berlitz, you know, back in the day, wrote about the Bermuda Triangle and the strange things going on. And that kind of predated a lot of the modern concepts of underground bases and deep-sea UFO bases and things. But at very least, you know, there's a commonality between the phenomenon that goes back hundreds of years from that area of the world, and the concentration of UFO sightings that occur there. So, you know, looking at it, especially in terms of phenomenology, you know, if we are researchers and investigators of the unexplained, and we have this you know, fundamental understanding based on history and historical evidence that strange stuff, weird crap happens down there in the Bermuda Triangle. You know, we can correlate that with UFOs and say, well, UFOs are strange. They seem to indicate a technology far superior to ours. And so perhaps some of the strange disturbances are indeed related to UFOs. To me, that seems like a logical way of explaining strange phenomena in parts of the world like the Bermuda Triangle. Another good area to use an example as an example of that is Brown Mountain or the Limbel Gorge in general here in western North Carolina where I live. And the LEMUR team, you know, Joshua P. Warren and myself and several LEMUR investigators have spent a lot of time on Brown Mountain researching earth lights that appear there. And in all likelihood, these things are probably something along the line of ball lightning. And of course, we know that lightning is essentially a manifestation of plasma, and that's the fourth state of essentially, you know, you've got your solids, and you excite those molecules until they become liquid, and then liquid excited further evaporates and becomes gas, and then gaseous particles excited even further become plasma, ionized air or other gases. When these molecules become excited to that point. That essentially is what lightning is. We really don't know all that much about, how ball manifests, but I think that really that's a logical explanation for what's going on at Brown Mountain. But interestingly, there have also been lots of reports of UFOs and even cryptid creatures like Bigfoot at Brown Mountain. So, you tend to find these quote-unquote paranormal hotspots, and once again, I'll say, at least superficially, it seems kind of ridiculous to me to try and say that there aren't parallels between these things and why they tend to all occur in a certain area. And if it really all does have to do with energy and vibration and electric fields and the like, then it seems to, make more sense to me that, dimensional shifts and things like that might occur from time to time. I'm not saying necessarily that, there is a portal, over the Bermuda Triangle or over the Limbel Gorge in western North Carolina, and that Bigfoot occasionally walks through that portal. I mean, that sounds kind of strange. But what I am saying is that, indeed, if there is some sort of a presence, that seems to indicate weird stuff's going to happen. And time again, it is reported that various instances of different strange phenomena occur there. How could they not be related?
Yeah, well, it kind of goes back to the two dimensions crossing the one dimension thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. How these manifestations occur, where they occur, what causes them, these are all things we don't know. I don't profess to have those answers any more than anyone else. But what I do know is based on record, and that's why I really have such profound respect for people like Lauren Coleman, Timothy Greenbeck, like Brad Steiger. Brad Steiger, probably above anyone else. He's done this for so long, and people like him and the other fellows that I've mentioned. These are the chroniclers, and these people are the ones who have traveled the world, and they have scoured the internet. They have picked through leafy old moldy books, smashed, in between shelves and dark library basements, all across the country and in colleges and universities and places, to find every piece of information and evidence and chronicle that on websites and in books, in newsletters, in radio and television interviews. They try and get that information out there so that it's available to people like us. And, man, I'll tell you what, right now with the World Wide Web available to us, we have such an advantage with the availability of information. I was on YouTube today, and my girlfriend and I were looking at a video of how to grill a steak a particular way. We were going to try and grill some steaks and do something a little differently how we normally would cook them, and I noticed that there was a link titled Ghostbusters, full movie. I clicked on it. You can go on YouTube and you can download, or not download, but you can watch in real time, videos, entire films loaded onto YouTube. Various other websites allow you to do this legally because they, pepper them with advertisements, but hey, everybody's got to make their nut and, make an honest buck. So it's fascinating to me that stuff like that, from entertainment to knowledge, scholarly research, articles, all this information is available on the web. And if it's not available on the web usually gives us access to archives and information that would help us find it wherever it may be elsewhere. And we have such an advantage as a result of that. And the work of people like Lauren Coleman, Timothy Green Beckley, and like I said, especially Brad Steiger, they've done so much for chronicling and keeping this information available. We have a lot to work from. We really, really do. And, you know, when you talk about these paranormal hotspots, I don't have the answers, but we have a better knowledge base probably than anyone in decades before us. And we'd be silly not to look for patterns and associations between these phenomena based on location, time frame, you know, frequency, and other factors that have been well documented by people like those that I've mentioned.
How about effects on people and their opinions thereof?
Oh, gosh, yeah.
I've never seen categorizations of that. I've never seen a categorization of subjective effects on witnesses. That would be quite interesting to me.
That's what, you know, probably if anything, I find that more interesting than objective data, because, you know, what is objective data? Objective, very, very loosely, could be defined as, you know, something that is, if it was a phenomenon being witnessed, several people saw it. And it's something that can be compared and analyzed from multiple perspectives. Subjective data, on the other hand, is I saw this, and you can take it or leave it, but I'm going to tell you what I witnessed and what I saw. And what's even crazier is when you get into crowd mentality and you talk about group sightings of things like UFOs and the like, and people talk about, you know, large groups, 15, 20 people all see a UFO, and they all have a different perspective of what they've seen. They all describe it being different. And it's fascinating because is it really because whatever these things are appear differently to different people, or is it because different people with different psychological and cultural backgrounds and upbringings interpret strange things differently? I think it was it Captain Cook when he first arrived in the West Indies, or the West Indies. I guess, you know, that's going to be the Americas, but what they called the West Indies. I can't remember if it was Captain Cook or if it was one of the other early explorers. So I don't want to get my information wrong and misquote somebody here. But I know that in some instance, when Western sailors arrived and they encountered the natives there, supposedly these natives weren't able to see the sailing vessel that these sailors had arrived in. But once they were taken out to the boat and shown and given an interactive experience, they were able to see it. And then when they could come back and tell their people on their terms, in their language, from their cultural perspective, what they were supposed to see, they too were able to perceive this, what at that time for them was very advanced Western technology, you know, naval technology. So it's fascinating because, you know, culture, upbringing and background, religion, philosophy, all these things, they do affect human perception of these kinds of phenomena subjectively. And you're right, because there don't seem to be enough psychological studies and things like that that really look into this, the subjective element, objectively.
Yeah. Or draw parallels between them. I heard or read an argument, or maybe it was on actually on UFO Mystic, where somebody had that same argument where they said that the people they encountered in the New World couldn't see the boats. And somebody actually referenced a first-hand account saying that, which described that these people could actually see the boats. They could see that they were something that floated on the water and were shaped like boats, but they didn't have a cultural reference to describe it. You know, they could see the things. Like if you showed an iPod to somebody in one of those uncontacted tribes in South America, they could see that it was a box that lit up. But past that, they have no reference for what the hell it's for. I mean, for all they know, it's for pounding nails in.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And you hear these weird Fortean reports of things like black mist that seem to kind of move through the air and essentially just kind of, they seem to be kind of autonomous, and they float around and they move and they act. We don't know what they are or what they do, And I'm not saying that there are a lot of reports of this sort of thing, but I think Patrick Weege's website, The Anomalist, actually had a link to an article just the other day that described something like this, a big black cloud that was just floating about 30 feet or so above, you know, people's backyards somewhere. And they're seeing this thing fly through the air, and they have no idea what it is. And it's just like, that could be the most, you know, advanced of alien craft that has ever visited Earth relative to, you know, human technology. We wouldn't know it, though, because relative to what we're seeing, it's the most similar in appearance to a cloud of smoke.
Or
don't know what that is.
The amorphous blob.
We don't know how it works, but it's funny because, you know, it's all, you know, based on subjective understanding and relative. I want to say the term relativity, but not like
Einsteinian
relativity. You know what I mean? You know, it's all relative to our own backgrounds and our understanding of the world around us. It's weird stuff, you know. And it's almost Lovecraftian in the sense that Lovecraft, in his fiction, loves to try and describe the undescribable. You know, he wouldn't describe darkness as dark. He would describe it as a complete absence of light. You know, he would describe things that were absolutely undescribable, aside from just being old and big and, you know, monster, you know, creepy, scary monster stuff, you know. It was so large, it was so creepy and slimy, you couldn't describe it, but he would try and do it anyway. And in that sense, it's like some of these strange phenomena that people report, these Fortean things, because they, you know, for lack of a better term, that's all they can be described as Fortean. They're so weird that they completely defy any frame of reference that we may have to them. And, I mean, how do you describe, how do you report that? How do you understand? How do you wrap your head around that? You know, it blows my mind even trying to think about it.
Yeah, well, another thing that I picked up from other people and have said is that the race and its understanding of it, the world around it, will need to change before we can move forward with describing what's going on in these weird situations during these sightings, mm-hmm. during these encounters. So, you know, I think it's going to have to come from inside rather than outside. Walter wants to ask you about Nikola Tesla right after he asks you this.
No, I was going to make a comment. That, but I will ask about Nikola Tesla and Lovecraft. I'm inclined to think now that we're not going to have a whole the whole race revelation or understanding. I really think it's going to go on the way it has been. There's going to be people who will come along who will figure this out, and once they figure it out and they accept it, they will become a part of the wider reality, as the wider reality will become a part of theirs. And for whatever reason, they won't necessarily share it. Well, I can give you the reason. I don't think they believe that it'll be accepted. And I think we get hints of this because all of us, I'm sure, have encountered something or reached some point. I've reached it where with certain encounters, you begin to not be so hot to share it with people because you realize that the sharing goes nowhere, generally. We come back to that circle jerk that Sigrid mentioned earlier, that, you know, there's a few people that, yeah, you're preaching to the choir, they understand, but I no longer believe that there's going to be some big revelatory event or experience where people are going to suddenly know reality or truth. I think it happens on an individual basis, and I don't know, that's just where I'm at right now. But on Tesla and Lovecraft, I'm in the camp of believing that they were both men who were enlightened of things that most people don't know. You know, Tesla, there is historical allusion to that. Lovecraft, I've come to believe that through some research I'm doing that I'm not going to talk about yet, but I do right now sincerely believe that Mr. Lovecraft stumbled upon something, was aware of something that he was essentially writing about in a fictional manner, but he definitely, I think he was aware of something that was real in the realm of the kinds of things he wrote about.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I have to agree with you. Lovecraft and Tesla both could be considered mystics. in a sense. They both kind of peered into a realm that isn't, you know, it lies beyond the realm of the five senses. Tesla seemed to struggle in his lifetime with trying to do it with, you know, his electrical prowess and his knowledge of electricity and engineering. It's almost like he had almost some sixth sense that allowed him some limited perspective of the unseen realm, so to speak. What he wanted to be able to do was to bring that to the five senses so that he could, you know, experience the totality. He had a fundamental understanding of something beyond, and he tried his entire life to reckon with that, with technology. And people would say, oh, come on, whatever, you know, I don't think he really thought that much of it. I really think he did. You know, he talked about how he spent a lot of his time every day for the last 30 years of his life communicating with extraterrestrials. And essentially what he did was he set up radio receptors, you know, and claimed to be able to receive signals from deep space. Now, granted, some of these things, you know, probably you know, radio emissions from, you know, places, you know, in the general locale of Saturn and things like that, you know, here within the within our galaxy, you know, they've been explained away as known celestial bodies that do produce radio frequencies. That, you know, we know those now, and we know what they are, and we can rule those out with modern SETI technology, which I think is incredibly outdated, personally. It's my humble opinion, but I think that truly if extraterrestrials were trying to contact us, you know, the people down in Australia who are doing SETI with laser technology as opposed to radio technology, I think that they're probably going to hit closer to the mark. I don't understand why a significantly advanced technology would use something so primitive as radio to try and contact us when we know that, you know, a laser, for instance, travels at the speed of light, and we might be able to utilize that, you know, more effectively. But all that aside, in a very primitive way, Tesla was already using radio-based SETI to try and communicate with other realms. And that right there is evidence, you know, to my mind that, you know, once again, he was trying to use his understanding of technology to broaden what lay outside of the five senses. And, you know, I think that Lovecraft was very much the same way. He talked about constantly, you know, actually, I got to tell a neat story real quick, but I'll preface that by saying that he constantly spoke about nightmares and dreams he had that were the influence for his stories. Years ago, I was given a really interesting book. It's called Marginalia. It was published back in maybe the late 40s, early 50s. I know it was published after Lovecraft's death, but there was a bishop in the Episcopal Church who was based out of Atlanta named Paul Reeves, and he was in poor health years ago when I was introduced to him, and he could hardly speak, you know, and he was being carted around in a wheelchair at the time. But my father, who's a minister, came home from church one day, and he says, Bishop Reeves wanted me to give you a book. He said he thought that you might find this useful. And I thought, okay, there's a former bishop of the Episcopal Church, you know, a holy man, who really wants me to have some book. He really wanted to give this to me. I thought, what is it? Is it a book about exorcisms or something? The book was Marginalia, and it was a book that was published after the death of Lovecraft that, you know, looked at some of his unpublished work. And it also had essays that he had written on things ranging from, you know, travel guides to places like Charleston, South Carolina, and some of his favorite U.S. cities, to, you know, synopses and articles written about how to write weird fiction. And when he described the process that he used to come up with ideas for the fiction stories he wrote, he always said, you know, sometimes I'll wake up in the middle of the night from a very particularly vivid dream, and I'll have to scribble down notes as fast as I can and try and recollect the outlandish horrors and the nightmares and things that I've witnessed in these dreams I've had. Many people equate dreams with predicting the future and psychic phenomena and things like that. Many people who have had recently deceased loved ones, you know, loved ones pass away, they'll have these deceased loved ones, you know, visit them shortly after their death in dreams and things like that. Dr. Raymond Moody, you know, perhaps best known for coining the term near-death experience and his work with psychomantium and mirror gazing and things like that. A very intelligent guy. I got to talk to him about this about a year and a half ago. And he talked about, you know, how the near-death experience is often something that occurs during a dream. And many people describe these experiences as being something that is not physical. It is not real, but it is so real, you know, in a mental sense, I guess, you know, being that a dream seems to be some sort of a manifestation within the mind, that it's almost more real than reality. And the mystics of ancient cultures around the world always talk about the fact that, well, in reality, what is real? The real aspects of culture and society, okay, are what we see when we're in that spirit realm. And this realm, our day-to-day lives, what we do while we're awake, this is the illusion. The real, the absolute truth, the great, you know, the meaning of life, if you will, the great cosmic truth, oneness, all these things that the mystics talk about, those things are kept in that spirit realm, and that is the actual world, the real existence to these mystics. Whatever that is, wherever it is, however you reach that, both Lovecraft and Tesla seem to be individuals who were trying to reach that, and the five senses weren't good enough. You know, they used mental processes, whether it be dreams or technology like Tesla did, that existed outside of what the five senses seem to be capable of understanding, and they strive for trying to reach those things. But, you know, the parallels in the work between not only, you know, Tesla and Lovecraft, but also, especially when you look at Lovecraft, he wrote this story about fish people that lived under the ocean called Dagon. I don't know if that was influenced by ancient Babylonian gods, but there were ancient Middle Eastern gods called Dagon, spelled the same way, that were fish people, anthropomorphic fish people. And that ties in with the entire notion of the Oans that visited the ancient Babylonians, who allegedly were people who emerged from the ocean and brought ancient civilizations knowledge of you know, geometry, mathematics, agriculture, all these kinds of things. You know, you also got what I mentioned earlier about, you know, in the Call of Cthulhu, he gives specific coordinates for where the sunken city of Relay, where Cthulhu supposedly rested, was, and that seemed almost perfectly to correlate with where the NOAA officials said that this bloop noise seemed to emanate from. Of course, there's the point I made about from beyond and about electrical devices resonating with the pineal gland. I think that Lovecraft said he wrote that story kind of playing off of René Descartes' idea about the pineal gland being the seat of the soul. Little did we know that the pineal gland, years later, thanks to the work of people like Rick Strassman, might be at least one element that is part of a greater whole that has to do with our entire understanding of interdimensional phenomenon and the way the human mind perceives these things. So yes, indeed, Nikola Tesla and H.P. Lovecraft were very mystical in their approaches to understanding the other realms, the things, you know, to borrow Lovecraft's term, from beyond. And I certainly agree with you and feel that they somehow may have been tapping into something that the five senses just simply can't handle.
Well, I think that Lovecraft actually, I believe he stumbled upon something actual in our world that was evidence of some of the things he wrote about. I think that this might have been part of why he and Clifford Eddy helped Houdini and Walter Prince and them go after the spiritualists. I think he might have been aware of some connection between the spiritualists and this stuff. And, you know, I'm one of those who's inclined to believe, you know, like it looks like Houdini may have been murdered, Lovecraft as well. But that's I totally agree with you on they were they were tuned in mystically, absolutely. Because as you said, all the stuff that Lovecraft experienced with his dreams, those weren't just normal dreams. Those weren't just normal nightmares. I think he was getting something there. And it might have been turned on by physical presence in certain locations that he had visited.
Yeah, and Lovecraft talked a lot about, you know, being drawn to certain places in his lifetime. For instance, there was a house down in the southeast that he used to visit that was called Dunroven. And one of our Luna investigators, Vance Pollock, actually mentioned, you know, having visited Dunroven. And it's funny, the name of the house actually came, the family that built the place, they'd traveled around a lot and everything. So they named it, it was a play on words, they named it Dunroven because they were done roving. And there was a young boy who lived there, and, you know, a lot of people would try and draw a parallel because Lovecraft loved to go visit this young boy, and they'd ride around in a boat on this lake next to the house and talk about weird fiction and strange things all day, and a lot of people kind of wondered about that. You know, Lovecraft was married, and his wife actually went on the record to say that Howard was a fantastic lover. I think that he was also, however, an intellectual elitist, and he would really revel in visiting with people who had, you know, a profound understanding of the intellectual aspects of life. And he seemed to be drawn to places like Dunroven, where he would visit that family, and the young son who lived on the property was very interested in strange phenomena and weird, you know, physics and stories of monsters and weird fiction. And he and Lovecraft would, you know, paddle around in a boat and wander around on the property and talk about this stuff pretty frequently when he was able to get down there and visit Dunroven. And, you know, that was one of many places, including Charleston, South Carolina, which I believe, in terms of ghosts and paranormal phenomena, is arguably one of the most, you know, bizarre places in the United States. I mentioned that Marginalia includes a article about Charleston, South Carolina, kind of a travel guide that Lovecraft wrote because he loved Charleston so much. These were only two places that he mentioned visiting where, you know, a lot of strange stuff is known to occur. And, you know, maybe he did have some sort of ability to kind of tap into things like that. Maybe, as you suggest, he was even made privy to things that were stranger than we could possibly, you know, guess. You know, even with the understanding that we have of his work. But, you know, it's funny because Lovecraft seemed to describe things at his time, you know, what I mean is basically at the time he had written them, things that would be described as monsters or weird or just something bizarre, ancient cult gods and things like that. And then you look back at the Call of Cthulhu and you hear these discussions of Cthulhu being one of these old ones, you know, one of these beings who can, you know, literally just propel themselves spiritually through space, fling themselves from star system to star system, and then somehow this creature is sleeping dead at the bottom of the Pacific Ocean, but he's not really dead. To me, this all translates to, you know, some sort of an extraterrestrial presence that is able to transport himself through space using, you know, interdimensional travel or other methods of propulsion that, you know, are far beyond what we understand even now, much less at the time that Lovecraft wrote these things. And, of course, you know, being imprisoned dead at the base of the ocean in a sunken city of non-Euclidean architecture, it sounds a lot to me like an alien entombed or, you know, suspended in animation who was banned to Earth and placed at the bottom of the depths of the ocean. And so many of these strange stories that Lovecraft wrote about had to do with things at the bottom of the ocean. Once again, I have to reference these Russian naval documents that talk about, you know, deep-sea UFO bases or the possibility of, and they weren't, you know, they don't, to my knowledge, directly reference deep-sea UFO bases, but they talk about the propensity for UFOs being seen, you know, underwater. And they go into notions that not only could there be UFOs, you know, in bases underwater, maybe, and that sounds like a crazy idea, but, you know, it's something that's worthy of its consideration. But they also talk about, you know, the fact that these things may have been here for a long time. So it's funny. These all seem to parallel what Lovecraft wrote about, these ancient deities, you know. Ancient civilizations sure as heck probably would have considered aliens gods, or demigods, and you have these references to Oans and Apakalu, Nephilim, so many different terms for all these different deities and creatures and things, you know, that have existed throughout history. The Anunnaki is another popular one, and David Icke and Derek Von Daniken and people like that have, you know, published dozens of books that deal with these sorts of topics, but who knows what they all are, and who knows if, you know, maybe if you know, these ancient kind of occult and esoteric aspects influenced Lovecraft and his fiction, but he unknowingly, or perhaps knowingly, was really tapping into something that, you know, has to do with an ancient extraterrestrial presence here on Earth. I don't know. But either way, I agree. I think he was definitely tapping into something, whether or not he was knowingly doing it or if he was just kind of channeling weirdness.
Well, there was a paper a few years ago by Joe McMonagle, who was the known as remote viewer number one, where he theorized that Jules Verne was a remote viewer based on one of his novels. I think it was Paris in the 20th Century or something, where he predicted things like, you know, elevators, telephones. Well, this was written in like the 1860s or something like that. Elevators, telephones, TVs, and even the internet.
I'll tell you, Jules Verne was visionary. He was almost Arthur C. Clarke visionary. You know, Arthur C. Clarke, predicted the radio communications satellite and various other technologies, you know, before they were created. And sometimes you could say that necessity is the mother of an invention, or vice versa, that, you know, well, science fiction, you know, creates these things, and then, you know, technology reading science fiction writers and, or, you know, people who are in charge of creation and, you know, furthering technology, you know, engineers or whatever, would read this fiction and say, oh, this is fascinating, cool, we need this. And then that idea sits in their mind for decades, and then finally they end up actually creating the technology. So you can say that guys like Arthur C. Clarke and Jules Verne predicted, or you can say that, you know, by using their imagination, they created, ideas that were the impetus for logical, technological feats that would follow. But I have to say about Jules Verne, what's fascinating is he wrote that book, Master of the World. The guy, to my understanding, never left France, or never left, at least far from France, never, you know, traveled to America or anything like that. But in Master of the World, he talked about a man who was piloting an aircraft that was similar to a dirigible. And he landed it on what was called Eagle's Nest in the Limbo Gorge in western North Carolina. And Eagle's Nest is apparently a large rock that is along the trail that leads to the summit of Table Rock in the Limbo Gorge. And it's fascinating because, you know, with our research, you know, and our, well, you know, once again, like I said, we know so little about ball lightning and ghost lights and things like that, you know, that it's hard to really say that there's a lot of research that can be done, but, you know, I know that, you know, I've been fascinated by the Brown Mountain Lights. I'd heard of them as a ghost story since I was a young child. Nancy Roberts and a lot of the American Southeast ghost writers would always write about the ghost lights of the Brown Mountain and the Limbo Gorge, so I've always been fascinated about that, and, you know, I've made many visits down to the Table Rock and Brown Mountain to try and see the lights. I've never actually seen them, funny enough, but, you know, I hope someday to see the Brown Mountain Lights. And I, having been to the Limbo Gorge, can attest to the fact that many of the things that Jules Verne described about that area, especially what was called Eagle's Nest on the side of Table Rock, these things correspond so perfectly with what he wrote about in Master of the World. And they said, oh, he'd get travel brochures and things, and he'd read these things, and, you know, he built such vivid mental images of these places that he'd never visited that he could write about them almost as though he were there. But I think almost that it's too perfect the way that Jules Verne was able to write about these things and the vivid descriptions he was able to give of places like that. He never came to America, and yet he described places like the Limbo Gorge, places I personally have visited, so well that I have to wonder, was the guy able to literally, envision these places so well that it really was, you know, more akin to remote viewing than just having a vivid imagination? So once again, you know, bring us back to that question, you know, is it all imaginary? Was he just using his imaginary better than most of us are able to do? Or was Jules Verne really tapping into something, much like Tesla may have done, or like Lovecraft may have done? Was he tapping into something else? I don't know. But you know, I could buy the remote viewing notion pretty easily based on what I've read.
Yeah, what you've read, people I've talked to, I've gotten to the point where
it's real.
I think that there is an as yet unexplainable talent to unhook from space and time. We were talking about this earlier, about time machines, and I've talked about this with Walter, too, that when there is a time machine where you can travel in time at will, it's not going to be a machine you can sit in, but a machine that you can hook up to.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think you're right. I don't think it's something that will be physical as we know it, or physical as you and I. You know, if someone were listening in on this conversation, I say, oh, you know, physical. It's going to be physical. Not physical as we know it. It's going to be something that transcends that. Probably, once again, technologically isn't going to do within our lifetime, but that's what fascinates me about psychedelic drugs and things. I'm not a user. I've never taken LSD or dimethyltryptamine, as fascinating as these things are to me. I've read about them.
Right.
I've never tried them. But, you know, I am fascinated because I feel like these things may indeed provide some sort of a gateway to, possibilities and realities that exist all around us that we are just oblivious to. And, yeah, if a time machine is ever created, it's going to be something that's going to have to tap into that. It's not going to be something we can get in and drive around in. It's going to be something that takes us there into a physicality that exists beyond what we understand right now.
Yeah, that's an even better description, possibly, of what's going on. The next host is not here yet, and we've got about 30 other things that we wanted to discuss. I thought the thing that you could get into before we have to go and have you back on another time, obviously, was something I think a lot of people would like to hear about. Are you working on making a flying saucer?
Am I?
This is a very simple way of saying something that's complicated, and it will get people to go, huh? What?
Oh, well, as much as I'd like to be able to do that, unfortunately, I don't have the technical know-how to be able to do that myself. The closest I can say I could come to working on making a flying saucer would be, Joshua P. Warren has what's called the Speaking of Strange UFO Experience every year. And Joshua, each year, takes, people from, the listening audience here in Western North Carolina of Speaking of Strange, and he takes them out into a field out in the country where there aren't a lot of city street lights and things, and we have a competition where people build, fake UFOs, usually using weather balloons and aluminum and lightweight material and things like that, and we just try and make the best fake UFO. And Josh's whole notion of trying to do this is, he hopes to try and essentially, build a knowledge base of how people can effectively hoax UFOs. And this year, once again, this is really top secret stuff. I can tell you, but it would take away a lot of the fun for people who might visit the UFO experience. So I'm going to keep it on the DL.
All right.
For the time being. But Joshua and some of the guys in Lemur have talked about to build a very special UFO, I'll tell you this much, something that would still be convincing looking in the daytime using, simple materials, balloons and things like that, but with the intent of trying to learn how other UFOs that people film frequently might be hoaxed. And I think that's very valid research that needs to be done. If we don't understand how people hoax things, we're going to continue to try and look at, videos on YouTube and whatnot and say, okay, is that real or is that somebody pulling our leg? So, I doubt I'll ever try and make a UFO unless it involves weather balloons and popsicle sticks.
Oh, okay. I was talking about the electric spacecraft thing that you mentioned to me in your email.
Yeah, the electric spacecraft, that was a journal that was published years ago by Charles Yost. He was a former NASA engineer.
Yes, I've seen it.
And Lemur does have a laboratory, but like I said, we've done a lot of research into paranormal phenomena ranging from ghosts and, some UFOs and things. The problem with UFOs is you never really know where a UFO is going to appear. You never really know where a UFO is, coming from or going to. And although, there have been instances where, U.S. military have said that they've tracked them on sonar and things like that, it's always really difficult to try and, guess where the next UFO sighting is going to occur. I'd say a good good possibilities somewhere in Central Texas, you know, after all the stuff that happened with Stephenville last year. But, you know, ghosts, you know, you people, oh, my house is haunted. Come over and check out my house. Well, you can go to that house, and whether or not I've ever seen anything in a haunted house, quote unquote, you know, there have been many instances where, you know, Lemur has, you know, observed strange phenomena. And also we investigated things where cryptids and things like that have appeared, crop circles, all kinds of stuff. And with all the different things that we've gathered over the years, the technology, we have tried to, you know, we put together a modest but a laboratory nonetheless that we are very proud of. And we, you know, we do try and test some of our theories in this laboratory, you know, that it could range from basically, you know, how can you use a camera to better try and rule out orbs in photographs. I personally don't think orbs are anything. And I'm sure I'm going to get, you know, a lot of angry emails from people after saying that. But, you know,
I already have.
You know, like I said, I'm very skeptical when it comes to things like that. And whatever they may be, you know, I actually had a member of PsyCop one time look at some orb photographs I'd taken with a film camera, and he said, I don't think they're ghosts, but, you know, it seems obvious that there's some sort of energy present there, and the camera's interpreting it. This was somebody from PsyCop telling me that.
Huh.
And he had a PhD also. But, you know, those kinds of things, you know, whether or not, you know, your laboratory is a kitchen, or if you're fortunate enough, like, you know, Joshua and I, to you know, to be able to, you know, put together a decent little workspace where we can do stuff like that, you know, and work on camera trickery and things like that to try and rule out hoaxes, or to try and do, you know, experiments with electrostatics and things like that. You know, that's something that we're focusing on right now. So building flying saucers, no, but, you know, trying to understand paranormal phenomenon a little bit better, yes, that's definitely something that Lemur is focusing on a lot right now.
Well, you know what? In light of what we've been talking about for most of the show, the paranormal aspect of the phenomenon, building a flying saucer would seem like something. There we go. We got the siren we always get during our show.
Squeezed it in.
You hear it?
Yeah, I hear that. Oh, hard to miss.
Yeah. Well, the fact of building a flying saucer would seem to be like sort of a useless thing to do, considering that they may not be physical all the time and may not be subject to the laws we think they would be if we were going to build a flying saucer or electric spacecraft or whatever you want to call it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You're absolutely right. It's difficult to try and say, oh, this is what they are or this is what they aren't. So, you know, who knows? But, you know, you hear all these stories. Dr. Stephen Greer with the Disclosure Project has said for years that, you know, I know he said this especially recently, that he thinks that a lot of UFO craft have been captured and have been back engineered, but that there are alien, you know, task forces from the outer cosmos who basically make it their business to make sure that humans, the warlike humans, can't travel to other planets. You know, I'm not trying to say that that's not what's going on. I think it's a little far-fetched. It sounds a little bit more like science fiction to me. Maybe, you know, humans have captured UFOs. Maybe we have back-engineered them. Maybe, you know, we know more about what's going on than we talk about. But I don't know, you know. I don't know. And UFO craft, and the notion of building flying saucer, you know, it's something that kind of escapes me. I'm very interested in it, you know, but I keep meaning to go and get my, you know, my physics and engineering degree so I can work on that, but it's nothing that I've found time for yet, unfortunately.
Yeah, okay, Micah, the next show is in Radio Antenna, so we're going to have to cut it short and have you on again so we can talk about the 30 or 40 other things that we had on the list here.
Oh, I'll look forward to it.
Yeah, me too. Do you want to give out any information for people who want to check out your work or get in touch with you before we sign off here?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you can just check out GralienReport.com. That's GRALIENReport.com. Or you can email me directly at info@GralienReport.com.
Okay, great. There's another quote here, which I thought was very appropriate from Silver Bridge. And it was from Alan Greenfield, who somebody asked, what does Gray Barker really believe? When they were sitting in a restaurant, Greenfield gave his own interpretation of what Barker believed. But this is why Barker is one of my heroes. He let Gray Barker listened to what Greenfield had to say about him. And then he said, I believe, he said after a long pause, in everything and nothing.
Yep, and that's great. That's a really good one. That's right along the same lines of what John Keel said. Belief is the enemy.
Right. Exactly. Okay, Micah, thanks so much for coming on, and we'll have you on again probably before the end of the year. And keep in touch, and thanks for being on.
Oh, Greg, we'll be in touch. You know that, man. We're homies, so I'll look forward to the next one. Have a great night. Thanks for having me on.
You too, Micah. Thanks.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye. Well, it's Micah Hanks from the Gray Alien Report, and we'll have him on again soon. I don't have a guest lined up. We've got a Fortean musical-type guest coming up in the next few weeks. Mr. Fab from what's the name of his site? I think it's called Weird Music. Oh, damn, I can't remember the name of it. Anyway, he's going to come in and play some weird music like he did last couple times. And other guests, which will be announced on the Radio Mysterioso site and or UFO Mystic. This interview will be up in probably 2 days at Radio Mysterioso. For download, thanks for listening. Radio Antenna's coming up. And apropos of some of our discussions here, here's something called the Yodeling Ghost from Patsy Montana, the singing cowgirl. Thanks for listening.
Everybody in the valley has the strangest tale to tell. A story of a haunted house and a ghost they knew so well. If you pass by the haunted house there in the dead of night, you'd hear a woman's ghostly wail, but there was no ghost inside, for it was the yodeling, yodeling ghost. She'd yodel in the cellar, hooray, hooray, the attic and the hall, hooray, hooray. As she wandered through the haunted house, you could hear her lonesome call.